So we now move to a beautiful topic about which you know everything and I've read a lot. So next week, you'll all be up here and I'll be sitting there asking you questions. And I mean that, so be ready. Okay. Well, let's start with the number of the catechism, number 1601, quoted, and it's actually quoting Canon 1005, paragraph 1, and it says this simple, lovely initial statement. The matrimonial covenant by which a man and a woman establish themselves between themselves, a partnership of the whole of life, is by its nature ordered towards the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. The order is important. That's my bit. This covenant between baptized persons has been raised by Christ the Lord to the dignity of a sacrament. With that statement, then, I'm going to take you for a good deal of today through the only area where I might be able to claim some knowledge anyhow, and that is Scripture. I want to take you to two crucial scriptural texts that have guided and formed the imagination of the Christian world forever. So I'm going to start with the book of Genesis and hopefully explain it in a way you may not have heard before, but I'm very confident in the explanation I'm giving you. Scholarship is harmonious in its agreement about it. We're going to start with Genesis chapter 1, which you have to say most probably, certainty is hard to get, was composed by the priests in the exile in the 6th century BC, the exile of Babylon. The priests didn't have a lot to do because the temple wasn't there. So this was what they could do. So they gathered the scrolls and the memory and they started to create what we call the Bible. The best way to read the Bible is to read it as though you're in exile in Babylon and you'll read it well, the Old Testament scriptures. Now the authors of this Genesis chapter 1, which I'll be quoting for you in a moment, draw on an ancient myth. Mythology is where people express their most religious concepts in the most beautiful way, deeper truths. So, ancient myth with a long oral history, no doubt. Now, while they're drawing on that, they're not creating it from nothing, they're not interested in myth as such. That's not their focus, these authors. And they're not interested in the cultic expression of myth, which you can find in many cultures, in the cult and so on. Now, they've got a point they want to make. What they're interested in, these authors of Genesis 1, are real people's lives. And therefore, they're interested in human behaviour and responsible action, formalised in the description of Adam. Adam in Hebrew means the human being as such. So we're not talking about a bloke, we're talking about human being. So own it if it makes sense to you. And the various relationships within which human beings lead their lives. Of course that's what he's interested in. The whole Bible is about that. It's about you and me, every man, every woman. What does it mean to be human? It won't have the last word to say on it, but it apparently has some lovely words to say on it that have been cherished for a long time. Quote, God said, let us make, the Hebrew word for God is Elohim, it's a plural, which takes us back, of course, to polytheism. And let us make is the gods in council, really, Elohim, because they're not yet monotheistic, we've talked about that in other contexts. Let us make humankind, Hebrew, Adam, in our image, according to our likeness. What a beautiful, poetic way to talk about being human. And I've suggested to you from my study, you may have other suggestions, four ways in which you and I are in the image of God according to God's likeness, the likeness of the gods. One, we're able to be in communion with God. We call it prayer. And our assumption is, perhaps a wrong assumption, that the plant, mineral and animal world don't seem able to do that. And of course at some huge level, human beings are quite extraordinary in this, beyond the normal animal world that we know. So you can understand them saying this. We're able to be in communion with God. Secondly, we're able to carry on God's action in bringing order out of chaos. That's what creation is in the Bible. It's not creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. That concept doesn't exist there. It's chaos. And creation is the act of ordering chaos, bringing intelligence to bear to order it. And God tells them, you go on and carry on what I've started. So that's our job, to bring order, not to bring chaos out of order, which is a dreadful greedy thing that a lot of human beings are doing and we can be part of. No, we're to bring order out of chaos, and not to leave it as a wilderness, but to make it beautiful with intelligence. Doesn't matter if you leave a bit of wilderness around, thank God it's there. But that our role is to, yeah. Thirdly, we are able to co-create human beings. These wonderful, God wanted human beings to exist, and God didn't just create human beings in his own likeness. He then said to him and her, get together for God's sake in love, and you do what I've just started. Carry it on. Wonderful. Fourthly, human beings can be only understood only in relation to God. I don't know you unless I know you're in God's image and likeness. Don't know you. I don't know anything about you. I can write books about human beings as though you're machines or psychedelic, whatever. But no, we only really, the key thing to know about me and about you is that we're actually in God's image and likeness. And that therefore we are essentially mysterious, because God is beyond comprehension. And if there's anyone in this world whom you love, and I'm sure there is, I bet you find them amazingly mysterious. So there's some suggestions. You can have others of your own, of course. I'm not trying to finish off the poetry, but just make some suggestions about it. The text goes on, let them rule over all creatures. Now, they don't use the normal word for rule there. It's quite a special word. I've got the Hebrew there for you, rada. I've got a senior moments. I think the normal word is mashal, but I've just forgotten what it is. But this is rada. That word is also found in another text. It's not the normal word used. So it's Ezekiel chapter 34, verse 4. That same Hebrew word is used. And the king in that is likened to a shepherd who should rule over, rada, as a shepherd, rule over the people with kindness. The king's role, according to Ezekiel, is a shepherding role. That's that. Ezekiel is full of this image. You know, he says, I will come and shepherd my people myself. And there's a big whole, whopping big chapter on the shepherds that aren't caring for the flock and so on. Well, this is the point of all this. He is a shepherding role. Not one of self-serving domination. In ruling over all creatures, human beings are to continue God's work of bringing order out of chaos, to care for the world the way a shepherd cares for the flock. That's the image. You've got it. Okay. The text goes on, Genesis. So, God created humankind, Adam, in his image, in the image of God, he created them. This is what God did. He didn't create one, he created them, of course. And them is male, Hebrew zakar, and female, nubuka. He created them, them. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and make it subject to you. subject to you, to your intelligence and your love and your caring. And God saw everything that he made, and it was very good. That's Genesis chapter 1. I think it's perfectly clear. And I hope it makes a lot of sense to you. But it can be misread. Let's move to Genesis 2. Genesis 2 is an older writing, so all the scholars tell me, and everything I've studied makes me affirm what they've said. It comes from the earlier century, the 7th century BC, which is probably, in fact, you can safely say the Bible was first, the first writings basically are from the 7th century BC. That's when writing became something that was done in Judah. So this is in the time of Josiah. It's before the fall of Jerusalem, obviously. Not long before, 20 years before. And the authors of this pre-exilic material edit in older material, of course. Material that's oral, maybe even bits and pieces of written stuff. And their interest is an older interest. It's interested in the paradox of the human being, how we are dust, but we're also spirit. Dust is, of course, inaccurate. But if you go to a graveyard years after a burial, and dust is not a bad word for what you think you see, dust to dust and ashes to ashes, you know. Okay, so we're made up of dust, all right, but we've also got spirit. We're made up of sanctity and sin. The wonder and limitations of the human experience. That seems to be the interest of Genesis chapter 2. And it reads, and notice even the terms are older, Yahweh God. This is another author, so-called Yahwist, because in the priestly writing, God is never called Yahweh prior to Moses on the mountain of Sinai, when Moses asks God in Exodus chapter 3, what is your name? And God says, Yahweh. They don't use Yahweh anywhere earlier than that. In the book of Genesis, in the book of Exodus chapter 1 and 2, they just call God, God, Elohim, the Hebrew word. But these people, this older mythology, calls God Yahweh right from the beginning. Obviously here, chapter 2 of Genesis, and throughout. And they call him Yahweh God. So they're not interested in the historical developments and all that. Yahweh God formed Adam, human being, from the dust of the earth, dust of the ground. And the word for ground, interestingly and not coincidentally, is Adama. God made Adam out of Adama. You could do that too. Look at the words. They're punning on words. They're playing with the words. And the ultimate meaning of both words is something like reddish. So we have the same colour as the clay or the dust of the earth a bit, you know. And it varies, of course, but that's right. So this is poetry. Yahweh God formed Adam from the Adamah and breathed, or the dust of the Adamah, the afar of the Adamah. So we're not clay, though that image is also used. Because clay, if you fire it, can kind of stay there forever. Like it's, we know, clay pottery. We're actually more fragile than clay. We're dust. The dust of the Adamah. So if you form dust into something, well, you have to keep your hands there or it'll fall apart. It's got no clinging there. So we're pretty fragile human beings. And that's where we come from. But we're more than that. He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And the human being, Adam, became a living being. So we're living because we, and you try it, if you don't breathe in for a few minutes, you won't be living. So you have to continually, God has to continually go, so that you can, and you don't hold your breath. You can for a minute, but it's nothing. Your breath isn't yours. The spirit, the breath isn't yours. It's something you have to give back, trusting that it'll be given again. And like Jesus on the cross, he uses the same word. Into your hands I commit my breath. Now, in the New Testament, it's Greek. In Jesus, it would have been ruach. He spoke Hebrew, Aramaic. So, This is what we're talking about. That's you and me. Beautiful, true, poetic, but quite deep. Human beings come from the dust, but live because of the divine spirit. Human beings are to live in dialogue with God and independent on God's word. We have to keep listening and drawing in the breath and then giving it back, or we won't stay around. Continuing to quote, Yahweh God said, and don't put this chronologically, you're dealing with poetry, don't have this happening first, this happening second, this happening third. It's a hold it all, like looking at a picture that's got many parts to it. You see that bit first and you see that bit second. But the whole lot is what you've got to look at. And look what Yahweh God is saying. It's not good that Adam should be alone. If you want to translate Adam as human beings, you can do that. In other words, when God says, yeah, we're going to do this, but we don't want the human being to be just one beautifully wandering around this earth. No. I'll make for him a helper. Him, forget the pronoun, it's irrelevant. And this is quite beautiful, a helper who will face him. And the scholars tell me it's actually quite a sexual image. Because a lot of animals act differently when they're... But we don't. We face each other. Not only sexually, but dialogue and talk and communication and... Okay, so it's got all that in it as well. Then the human being, that's Adam, said... Because before that, I don't give you all the animals are brought by as if they're going to be okay, you know. And Adam says, "Oh, go on, give it a break, give us a break, give us a break." And then, you know about the rib and the word in Assyrian for rib and the word in Assyrian for woman. They play against each other. They're like Adam and Adama. They're not like that in Hebrew, which is a clear indication that this myth goes right back to an ancient Assyrian text, because the play on word rib and the play on word woman make a pun in the Assyrian or Chaldean text. So, here we are. He says, and then at the end, when all these animals have gone by, suddenly Eve is there. I should have brought it. Anyhow, I forgot. Eve is there, and this is a lovely word. The first words spoken by a human being in the book of Genesis are spoken by Adam when Eve's there. And now you've got two, of course. And he says, Zut. He says zut about three times, and you can hear it. And you've all had that feeling, I'm sure. He says, zut, this at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This one will be called woman, Isha, because out of Ish this one was taken. So you've got that story. So you've got an Ish. You don't have an Ish before you have an Isha. There's no Ish there, and then you get an Isha. No, you've got Adam. You've got human beings in the mind of God, and he makes them both, and neither of them is complete without the other. So, male and female are both part of the original creation of humanity, obviously. Man doesn't exist before woman, nor are they created separately. God created Adam. And then, but that's not chronologically, of course, divided what he had in two. Each part lacks the other. The only way to create human beings was to create an Ish and an Isha, who both need each other. Otherwise you can't do all the things God asked us to do, namely co-create. Human beings are man and woman facing each other in equality and dignity. They need each other in order to carry on the blessing and give life. And the first direct speech of a human being is a cry of delight from a husband to a wife. I'll now take you through one more text, then we'll have a break. And the second text I want to take you through is the New Testament text, Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21 to 23, in which Paul, the only time really, he talks to some extent, that many verses, about relationships between husband and wife. And they've done a lot to form our consciousness. And these words would have to be among the most misquoted, misused words of the New Testament still by so-called evangelist Christians who do something with goodwill, I'm sure, maybe even sanctity, but they do something with the Bible which is dreadful. They take the Bible words and lock them in as though they're totally unchangeable, forgetting the whole point of Revelation, which I must have said to you 100 times. For us as Christians, it is not the book that is the revelation, as it can be and usually is for Judaism and Islam. They're religions of the book, and I'll treat them with all the respect they want, but I want to say about Christianity, that's not for us. The revelation for us is the person Jesus. The book is an inspired response to that person. But it's a human response, because who else are you going to inspire? And that human response, inspired as it is full of beauty and wisdom and wonder, because people have treasured it and preserved it and kept it and handed it on. But it's a first century inspired, beautiful response. And the authors, Paul, for example, is not that stupid, for heaven's sake, to write a letter in the first century that he wants quoted in the 21st century verbatim, as though that's still what he would have written in changed circumstances. For heaven's sake, can't you see that? So, well, yeah, you can't even say yes or no to that, but you've got to be able to see that. Or we're missing the whole. What we're doing is, for our own security, we're locking ourselves into a written word unintelligently. That's the point I'm making. Because God inspired Paul to write to real people in a real situation. And no doubt what he said they accepted as beautiful, so it must have been relevant to their situation. Take a situation that's so different, remarkably different, with commonalities, of course, then we can be inspired by Paul, we can be helped by Paul. He can give us the tools and the insight to help us make intelligent decisions now that are inspired about our new situation. But we can't quote him and be inattentive to the realities of our present world. Having said all that gently to you, I'm going back now to look at what Paul did say to the Ephesians. Let's be fair to him first, before we do this big job that you and I have to do today for our world, inspired and helped by him. Paul begins his comment with a wonderful statement. He says, Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21, "Be filled with the Spirit." And one way of being fulfilled with the Spirit is, "Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ." That's the overarching statement that he makes before he gets into marriage. Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. This statement, leave it, put it up there, cuts right across the so-called family values of Paul's society. And when people talk about family values today, please permit me to be very curious, very sceptical, and very careful. Because often when people talk about family values, they're trying to uphold their own position of power within the family. You know, there are family values. I had plenty of them in my childhood. I hope you had plenty in yours. And I'm not saying all family values. But Jesus' idea of family values are subject to critique. Remember, he says, brother will fight against brother, sister against sister, daughter against mother, mother-in-law. In other words, that you have to get an insight here, and the insight into God's love and into loving one another as I have loved you. If that goes counter to your family values, you have to let your family values go. So what Paul actually says here cuts across the accepted mores of the first century Jewish and Gentile world. It's quite revolutionary. Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. Then he addresses wives. I'm leaving out verses, of course. No, there's none left out there, but I've given you the whole thing. If you want the whole thing, you'll have to buy a $50 book that I wrote on Paul's letters, which is my best commentary, I think. And it's all carefully argued there if you want to go through that. He says, wives. So, be subject to your husbands as you are to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, just as Christ is the head of the church, the body of which he is the Saviour. Just as the church is subject to Christ, so also wives ought to be in everything to their husbands. So, that's what he says. Paul obviously assumes the traditional structure of his time because he's talking to real people. So he's talking to them in their real situation, and in that real situation, authority was invested in the husband for quite obvious reasons, perhaps not obvious to you, but they're obvious historically, and I've pursued this as far as I can go with any evidence. Other things may open up that make what I'm saying now not entirely true, but I'm giving it a fairly simple view. A traditional family, just imagine it, is a girl who has just able to be a wife and a mother, say 14, 15, kept by her parents at home, veiled, private in the public world, not seen in the outside world, protected, because she has a marvellous, beautiful thing to do, to be a mother and a wife. So that's how it is. The public world is a male world. So the rulership out there, the leadership out there, she typically marries a man who's in his middle 20s, who has gone to rabbinical school, knows reads many of them, if he can, has a trade like Paul had of stitching leather and things like that, so he can support her. And then the father, this is not typical, but we still can't do it, brings her down the aisle, hands this little girl over, this young woman, but little girl in a way, to this other man to protect. And of course, in the home, you know what you'll do. Mothers, I don't have to tell you who's going to be running the home very quickly. And surely it's the woman. And let's look at it at its best, with love developing and all of that, of course. But in the public world, she doesn't know how to write checks. She doesn't know how to drive cars. She doesn't do anything out there. He does that. All right. So now, with that in mind, that's the situation that he's writing to. Every wife, she's got any brains, she will get her husband will tell her what to do. We'll move now, we'll go to Basra because it's safer there. Or Joseph says to Mary, we're going off to Egypt. So Mary says, sure, because she doesn't know where Egypt is, she doesn't know how to get there, and she hasn't got a car. Do you get me? It's the public world. Well, Paul is assuming that structure, but look at what he says. His accent is on how the wife is to be subject. He's not telling her to be subject. She's already doing that. But he's telling her how to do it and how the husband is to exercise authority as head of the household. They're the key words. Wives, you could say, when you're subject to your husbands, do it this way. Do it as you are subject to the risen Christ. That already implies if the husband tells you to do something which is against your faith from the risen Christ, you don't obey. You got that, haven't you? Mm-hmm. It's a way of doing it. And the husband is the head of his wife, not any old way, not to get his own will, not to be authoritarian, not to rule the blooming place and take no regard for her. He's giving him the only way you can exercise authority now is the way Jesus did. And for God's sake, if you read the gospel, didn't Jesus do it by service? Didn't he do it by laying down his life? And Paul will go on to say all that. So, though Paul is not suggesting a change in the authority structure, what a fool he was. Who do you think Paul is? Do you think he's that blooming stupid that he can suddenly change the world? Paul had a focus, and his focus was to get people to know about Jesus, because that'll change everything. And it won't change it till they get to know him. So he's always got this burning focus. And issues of public life, politics, should there be a Roman Empire, should there be slaves in the Roman Empire, a bit like saying, should you have bosses and people, should you have this, should you have the economic system we've got today, should you have AWBs, and oh, for God's sake, somebody's got to work all that out. But Jesus wasn't talking about it a lot. He was saying, love one another as I have loved you, because he knew if we did, we'd work all those things out. So Paul's likewise the same. He's not suggesting a change in the authority structure of a Christian family. He's introducing a reference to Christ, a revolutionary principle, which must bring changes to the traditional structure if people listened to what Paul said. Christianity was a marvellous thing in the first 3 centuries, and no doubt it's still a marvellous thing. But when Christianity became allowable in the 4th century under Constantine, and then under Theodosius, a later emperor, became the official religion of the church, it became upwardly mobile to be a Christian. How much conversion went on in that process? How many people got the message? Or did Christianity or Christendom become a kind of a global tribal thing that people belonged to without perhaps knowing anything about it almost? That's the danger, isn't it? Obviously. So how many people were converted to Christianity, or how much did Christianity have to compromise to absorb everyone in, is a complex question that we're still living with. I'm living with it, you're living with it, the whole blooming world is living with it, necessarily. Husbands, he says. And look at the key word is just as. That's the key word. Husbands, love your wives. He's presuming they do. But do it just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her in order to make her holy by cleansing her with the washing of water by the word. Can you hear baptism in there? So as to present the church to himself in splendor without spot or wrinkle of any kind. Yes, so that she may be holy and without blemish. The imagery of that little statement comes from the nuptial preparation of a bride for the nuptials of the day. And we'll use different images now, but not too unlike that. But it's also taken from baptism. It also draws on Old Testament imagery of God as the bridegroom and Israel as the bride. And Paul is using imagery to describe the loving care that Christ has for the church. He's doing 2 things. He's holding up mirrors. He's looking at marriage in the light of Jesus, and he's looking at Jesus and the church in the light of marriage. So there's a reflection going from one mirror to the other, and we're looking both ways, and we're learning about Christ and the church, and we're learning about marriage at the same time, because they're each mutually shedding light on each other. He also explores the meaning that this intimacy between Christ and the church has for the understanding of the consecrated love of husband and wife. He continues, in the same way, husbands should love their wives as they do their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. No one ever hates his own body, but he nourishes and tenderly cares for it, as Christ does for the church. Because we're members of his body. And he quotes Genesis, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So in quoting Genesis 2:24, his words are to be read in the light of the Genesis narrative, which I've just shared with you, however briefly. Incidentally, we mustn't forget that in the narrative, the Genesis narrative, when God comes and finds out about the sin, man-woman sin, remember there's punishments for each one? Or I should say, consequences of their action. And one of the consequences for Eve was that she would have pain in childbirth. That's obviously not a thing that God decided way back there. I would assume pain in childbirth has been going on since the beginning, unless we've lost ways of dropping children. I don't know what's happened since the apes. But, you know, there is a lot of pain in childbirth. That's not an extra. But that when they're telling the story, everybody knows about that. So he says, well, that's why. So don't, you know, make sure you don't disobey God and, you know, that kind of thing. And one of the other pains of that the woman is going to suffer is domination by her husband. That's not nature. That's the consequences of sin. In other words, it's a bad thing. Do you get it? In the Genesis narrative, it's a bad thing. It's not what ought to be, it's what happened because of sin. Just as weeds are not what ought to be, but they happen because of sin. They didn't happen because of sin, but and just why snakes don't have legs, that's a consequence. God couldn't think of too much to do to the snake. So he made him crawl around the earth and eat dust for the rest of his life. I hate to tell you, he never eats dust, yes. But that's what they thought they ate, because they go on like that all the time and there's nothing down there but dust. So we're dealing with a story, for heaven's sake. It's a story. Get on with it. So, I want to make that point. Then he finishes. This is the story. This is a great mystery. And the Latin word in the Vulgate of Jerome is sacramentum. Hence the sacrament of marriage. This is a great sacrament. And I'm applying it to Christ and the Church. Marriage is a sacrament of God's design to draw everyone into consecrated love communion in the body of Christ, the Church. Paul is presenting the communion in love of husband and wife in Christ as a special witness to the mystery of divine communion that exists between Christ and the community that lives by Christ's Spirit. And he concludes using a word that he used in the very first sentence. Each of you, however, and he's addressing the men because the men would read it and then in the assembly, and then they'd read it out to their wives and explain it because the wives hadn't gone to school and couldn't read and all that kind of thing. So each of you should love his wife as himself, and a wife should, translation, reverence her husband. But the actual word used is phobeo, which is actually fear. Phobia, you've heard the word phobia. So we're using this strange word fear, which comes from the fear of the Lord. Paul uses the same word as at the beginning of the passage, because when he actually said to them, be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ, the Greek is en phobo Christou, in the fear of Christ. I mean, if you want to just take it. But fear obviously isn't a very good English word to translate any of this. Fear of the Lord, or so we're not saying be afraid or scared of Jesus. We're saying whatever that is, that awe, sense of the sacred, that sense of mystery, that sense of being small and not too self-knowledgeable and self-confident and whatever, just that reverence that we have for Christ.